You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, did you know honeybees are, in effect, farm animals that aren't native to the U.S.? A conservation biologist explains the difference between honeybees and the many native bees of North America and the role each plays in our ecosystems. Now, the weeks after the college football bowl games wrap up aren't normally the time when Wisconsin Badgers fans are most fired up about their team. But there seems to be a lot of buzz around new head coach Luke Fickell as he's assembled his coaching staff, added to his recruiting class, and brought in prominent players through the transfer portal. Jake Kokorowski is a Badger athletics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Jake, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate you.
Yeah, this seems like the opposite time of the year for people to get excited about college football. But I keep hearing stuff. Jake, what's going on?
Yeah, it's, you know, with obviously the hire in late November of Luke Fickell, a surprising hire, really, obviously, with him, how he stayed at Cincinnati. But, you know, through the years, and you know, he's been kind of a name in the, you know, coaching carousel of throughout the years. But, you know, he decided to take the Wisconsin job. And but you've seen with college football, too, it's also just kind of maybe as a broader view. College football never ends, it feels like, where you have right now, you know, you have the regular season, right, where it's September, late August, September through first couple weeks of January. But you also have the conditioning in the winter, but there's recruiting. And I think that's part of it with the excitement where, you know, but there's a point in time where, you know, and recruiting is huge right now. It's for any program. It's in all programs are continually recruiting high school prospects, you know, juniors, seniors, sophomores, others, you know, and it's a all year round process. But what Luke Fickell and his new staff did, you know, in the latter part of the recruiting cycle for the 2023 class was, you know, they signed a couple of 4-star prospects, you know, that, you know, Amari Snowden, Braden Moore are two names. They're defensive backs for Mike Tressel's, you know, revamped defensive scheme for the Badgers. You know, they, you know, so that's part of it. You know, at one point they had 8 verbal commitments for that 2023 class. And, you know, in December, after some kids reopened their recruiting process, but they ended with, you know, 15 as of it was last week when a week ago today, we found out that Jamel Howard Jr., who's a highly recruited defensive tackle out of the Chicago area, he announced his verbal commitment and eventual signing with Wisconsin at a crucial position, which is a nose tackle position on the defensive line. But you've seen this staff with the energy and you're seeing them, you know, make early connections, establish great rapport with players. I guess the kudos goes to them for really, I would say, keeping the recruitments, the commitments of the players that already had committed underneath, you know, previous head coach Paul Christ and whatnot. And then you go further that, and then you look at the transfer portal where that's where that you've seen a lot of, you know, I think a lot of energy come from there with what they've done in terms of having, you know, 13 scholarship signees come on board, a 2-year starter at SMU and Tanner Mordecai, who's going to be a 6th-year player, but he threw for, you know, 70 plus touchdowns in the last 2 seasons at that Group of 5 program. You get 2 other, you know, former 4-star quarterbacks, you know, Nick Evers and Braden Locke to compete for the backup spot too. So there's a revamping of the quarterback room. And on top of that, you know, you have, they have 4 commitments, you know, signees, if you will, for the wide receiver position where they wanted to, you know, revamp that room, add more numbers underneath Phil Longo's scheme.
And
you know,
Jake, that's a lot of what's happening on the field. We don't have too much time. I also wanted to get into, it seems like the approach to fans is different. There's a little more pizzazz in the announcements of all these signings you just mentioned. Maybe some changes in what fans will have access to in the preseason. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, it's really a lot too. I think, a couple of things. One, you know, you have like the billboards that they put up there for the fans in the Milwaukee area throughout Wisconsin. It was part of their kind of recruiting. They called it a blitz, if you will. And basically it was a presence where right after it was called a contact period where you could start reaching out and seeing recruits. They targeted Wisconsin and they targeted, you know, Illinois. So they called it like a Wisconsin-Chicago blitz. And so you saw some billboards up throughout the state of Wisconsin. There's one in Illinois. There's an alumni event just last week, guys, that when you take a look at it, I talked to the president of the UW Alumni Association chapter there, in Milwaukee. And she said that, they registered 375 people for this Big Red Rally, which is, a big event. And Luke Fickell was there talking, and that was 25 above their sellout count, their goal that they had had. So there's a lot of energy there. You talk about also coming up April 22nd, they are talking about the launch, which is going to be, essentially it's not going to be a spring game. I know a lot of programs around college football do spring games, but it's going to, sounds like, according from what we've heard from UW spokesperson, it's really just a nice way to they're going to have an open practice, and then there's going to be a scrimmage involved too, from what it sounds like. So, they have a lot of buzz there. I mean, even with me, I've been on vacation this week, y'all. And to be honest with you, like, I can't stop hearing commercials on the radio here and there. There's, I've seen like at least one TV ad. So you're seeing like, I'll be honest, we haven't dove in yet to just if they're marketing more or just how much money they are. That's an idea I'm hoping to do once I get back from vacation. But it's one of those things where this is, there's a lot of momentum for the fans. You're seeing, there's a lot of momentum or energy there. We'll just see what happens, because they, you hear about it off the field, but on the field, they haven't even gone on to spring football, where they have 15 practices coming up. Maybe we have to check dates, but it's in the spring where they're allowed 15 practices with these players, and they have to implement a new offensive scheme. They'll have to see what they do with the defense now and trying to merge two different defenses. But there is a lot of buzz with Wisconsin football right now.
And Jake, just in our last minute, on the offensive side, do we have a sense of what the game is going to look like? Meat and potatoes, running game, high flying passing game. What are we expecting?
Right. Yeah. And that's, Phil Longo comes over from North Carolina. He's the offensive coordinator and quarterbacks coach for Wisconsin. He brings what they call an air raid scheme, which is very much a passing scheme. It's a different type of passing scheme. Mike Leach at Mississippi, Mississippi State, used that, throughout his various stops, and many others throughout college football and the pros use some form of an air raid offense. So you should expect a lot more passing, I would say, a lot more balance, but they're not going to go away from the run game, which has made Wisconsin so prevalent in what they've been known for, right? You also have a 1-2 punch in Braylon Allen, who's going to be a junior, along with a senior in Ches Malusi, who could be a great 1-2 punch. But I would expect more passing out of them and out of the Badgers, especially with, they have, I think it's 12 or 13 scholarship, or I think it's 12 scholarship wide receivers that would be on its roster for this season at the moment. There could be a lot of, I think there's going to be a lot more energy that way in terms of the passing game and creating opportunities that, Wisconsin's running game won't have to block, eight or nine guys in the box each and every play. I think Wisconsin can do more that way through the air.
Jake, we'll leave it there. Thanks for bringing us up to date.
Excellent. Y'all have a great week. Take care.
You too. That's Jake Kokorowski, Wisconsin Badgers sports reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, with us to discuss some of the buzz around the Wisconsin football program and the early days under new head coach Luke Fickell. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a classic bar tradition that takes place all year long.
The Meat Raffle, a beloved game where the prize is a frozen turkey, a box of steaks, or a chain of sausage links. For writer and vegetarian Patty C., winning a package of meat can bring on peak joy at her favorite local taverns.
A vegetarian walks into a bar for the Meat Raffle and air conditioning. I know it sounds like the start of a bad joke, but I recently visited Heartbreakers Bar and Grill to try to win packages of frozen meat on a 97-degree June day. My husband, Bruce, calls this stretch of Highway 00 near our house the Lake Halley Strip. A little less bling than the one in Vegas, but entertaining in its own way. I've been a vegetarian on and off since high school. For the last 15 years, I've eaten mostly a plant-based diet, but I still enjoy making fall-off-the-bone pork roast, slow-cooked barbecue ribs, or rare steaks and burgers. I'm also an ex-smoker who will light your cigarette. A meat raffle is like every raffle. Buy a ticket and wait for your number to get called. As a Catholic, I've been playing this sort of game since I could hold my own paddle, usually a paint stick with markered on numbers. At each church picnic, I won more cakes or pop bottles than my family could carry. Meat raffles are a long-standing Wisconsin tradition, from small-town VFW halls to big-city hipster bars, enjoyed by 90-year-olds to 20-somethings. Turns out, World War II-era meat rationing in Britain prompted the first meat raffles. People pooled their meager protein supply, and some lucky chap won enough for a feast. This concept soon caught on in the United States. Years ago, when Bruce first read Meat Raffle Tonight on a Highway 00 tavern marquee, he thought it was a cool band name. We still laugh about that. Other businesses away from the Strip, like the Eagles Club or Lake Halley Sportsman's Club, hold meat raffles for local charities. The Eagles takes a break June and July. That means for 10 months of the year, a winner could bring home the bacon 3 nights a week, just in Lake Halley alone. Each time you buy a drink at Heartbreakers on Tuesday after 5 p.m., you get a meat raffle ticket. Where else do the odds of winning increase the more you drink? The raffle begins at 6 sharp. The second number called is mine. I whoop my way from our table to the bartender to verify my ticket, and then whoop some more to the spread of frozen meat. It's as if my name's just been called on The Price is Right. Only today, it's not Bob Barker, but the 20 or so other patrons who smile patiently while yet another middle-aged contestant screams. I poke through the prizes, a two-pack of ring bologna or a whole chicken, a bag of cheese curds or beef sticks, pork tenderloin or a rack of ribs. I settle on a pound of jumbo shrimp. I never won crustaceans before, so of course I hold the frozen bag over my head like a trophy and whoop my way back to our table. We order another round of drinks. Soon my cousin's number is called. We all cheer. She chooses the ribs. Later, Connie teases me, "Think there's a vegetable raffle somewhere?" Bruce says no one would go. I would, of course. And you know, I'd win something.
Patty C. is a writer from Lake Halley, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll learn about the differences between honeybees and the many native bee species of North America. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, you may have heard in the last few years that honeybees were under threat after an increase a few years back in a problem known as colony collapse disorder. Those honeybees are a non-native species in North America. They play a huge role in agriculture, both in honey production and for pollinating a wide variety of crops. But the concerns about honeybees and their importance in agriculture may have overshadowed a big ecological problem. Many of the nearly 4,000 bee species that are native to North America are under different forms of threats because of habitat loss, pesticides, and other reasons. Rich Hatfield is a senior endangered species conservation biologist and bumblebee conservation lead at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I want to spend a little bit of, or most of our time on the native bees. I want to touch on honeybees for a moment. We might look at bees and think bees are bees. Honeybees have a very different background and story in North America. Can you tell us a bit about that history?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, they're not native. They were, so they weren't naturally here, but back in the early 1600s, as Europeans were moving to North America, because honeybees provided a source of sugar and also a source of wax, they decided to bring them over. And the earliest records were in the early 1600s, I think 1620s. And I think their first arrival was in Jamestown, Virginia. And records indicate that by sort of the mid-1800s, that honeybees had reached to the West Coast and been spread by people all the way out there. But all of the history of the European honeybee or the Western honeybee coming to North America involves humans bringing them here. They weren't here on their own. Although it is worth noting that there is a early fossil of a related species, a related honeybee in the genus Apis that was found in Nevada a few years ago. So there may have been a native honeybee at one time, but that was millions of years ago and went extinct before people were ever in the picture.
And then let's turn to native bees. Thousands of different species native to the continent. I understand we've been talking about honeybees. The native bees of North America, none of them produce honey. Do I have that right?
None of them produced any measurable amount of honey. We have around 50 species of bumblebees, and they may produce sort of small pockets of honey that they feed their larvae when they're developing. But almost all of our native bees spend their winter hibernating. So they sleep through the winter. So they have a different strategy for surviving, whereas honeybees spend all summer making that honey. So they have something to eat in the wintertime, and they overwinter sort of alive, which is different than our native bees.
What are some of the main strategies of overwintering, a big issue for a native bee here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, most of them are overwintering in a small hole in the ground, probably, you know, in your garden or in a yard somewhere. Some of them also overwinter in like pithy stems or twigs of trees or shrubs or even perennial plants. And so actually leaving some of that material in your yard is really important. Leaving some of those dead stems up and actually leaving some of the leaves on the ground provides really important insulation that protects those animals through the winter.
A lot of your work, of course, has to do with endangered and threatened bee species in North America. How endangered are some of these bee species?
The short answer to the question is we don't really know. There are, I think you mentioned, there are thousands of species of native bees to North America. And so in the United States and Canada, we have somewhere around 3,600 species. And for most of those species, we have very little understanding of their conservation status. But we do have a pretty good understanding of the conservation status of bumblebees, which are fairly well studied. Most people are probably familiar with them. They're large, robust, black and yellow for the most part, and they're fairly well studied. And we have some indication that around, or not some indication, the data indicates that around a quarter of them are facing some degree of extinction risk. And several of them are critically endangered. One species, Bombus franklinii, or Franklin's bumblebee, which is native to Northern California and Southern Oregon, actually hasn't been detected since 2006. And some folks actually think it may already be extinct. And then there in Wisconsin, you know, you have the rusty patch bumblebee, which is a federally listed endangered species. And so the two species I just mentioned, the rusty patch bumblebee and Franklin's bumblebee, are two bumblebees that are federally listed as endangered. And then there are actually seven yellow-faced or hyalaeus bees that are endemic to Hawaii that are also on the endangered species list. So I know that's kind of a long answer to your question, but in short, it sounds like really when we start looking at the data that around a quarter of the species are probably facing some degree of extinction risk.
What are a couple of the biggest reasons that these bees are endangered?
Well, you mentioned them in sort of your introduction of the segment. You know, habitat loss is a major one. The use of insecticides is also incredibly important, especially over the last, you know, 20 to 25 years or so has been an increasing use of systemic insecticides, which are water soluble and get into plants and are expressed in the pollen and nectar, which are the only food for bees. So that's a really important source of a threat for them. And climate change is also a major factor as well. It's changing the time at which our plants bloom, and it's causing sort of crazy springtime, winter storms, and other things that are just impacting their life cycle. And And so all of these factors sort of keep piling on top of each other, and you get a scenario that is commonly referred to sort of as a death by a thousand cuts. And another factor that's really happening, especially to some of our bumblebees, is disease is a major factor. So, you know, you mentioned honeybees at the beginning. There's some pretty good evidence that shows that when we move honeybees around, we're actually moving diseases around with them as well, and they can pass those diseases to our native bees as they visit flowers with each other. And there's also a commercial bumblebee industry that is believed to be amplifying and spreading diseases throughout the country. So a lot of threats out there. But the good news is a lot of those things are things we can do something about. We just need to band together and work to mediate to get rid of those threats.
And very briefly, just in our last half minute, you mentioned we can leave our yards untidy in the winter to help. Can we make a difference literally by planting native flowers for the rest of the season?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the great things about pollinator conservation is it's a build it and they will come scenario. If you start putting habitat in the ground, and the Xerces Society has a ton of resources on our website to help you do that, you will bring bees there. And that's what we're really encouraging folks to do, is to focus on building habitat rather than, say, getting a honeybee hive, because you may be bringing them into the system that doesn't have enough food to feed them already. So we want to focus on building habitat, and that will support our native bees and the honeybees that are already on the landscape.
Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Rich Hatfield with the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. He talked to us today about native bees, many of which are endangered or threatened, and how to help them out around North America. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it can be hard to have good conversations about difficult topics, but it can be done. We'll get some advice with the authors of the new book, Say the Right Thing. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk a lot about our rights in the United States, but do we live up to our responsibilities? We'll talk to the author of the new book, The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden's State of the Union address last night was met with some outbursts from lawmakers in the crowd. A political rhetoric expert joins us for a look at the speech. First, the Bill of Rights is one of the cornerstones of American democracy. And in our political conversations these days, we talk a lot about protecting our individual rights and liberties. But our next guest is worried that we're forgetting another important part of American citizenship: responsibilities and obligations. In his new book, he argues that rights all by themselves are not what should define American citizenship, and that meeting our obligations as citizens is vital if our democracy, our political experiment in the U.S., is to continue and to inspire other countries around the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be part of the job description of being an American citizen? Do you think people are well-informed enough about politics, participate enough in daily and yearly politics? Do you want to see more civics education in schools? Just a few of the ideas our guest talks about in his book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Richard Haass is president of the Nonpartisan Council on Foreign Relations. He's served in the Pentagon, State Department, and White House under four presidents from different parties. He's written and edited a lot of books, including The World, A Brief Introduction, and Foreign Policy Begins at Home. His newest book is called The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me.
You've had a career filled with looking at foreign relations and international threats to the United States. What turned you toward looking at the elements of citizenship?
Turned me to it initially is when people would invariably ask me what keeps me up at night. Instead of saying China or Russia or North Korea, I started saying us. And I started thinking about it, and it's essentially the threats to either the functioning of American democracy here at home, the gridlock that increasingly makes it difficult or impossible for us to pass policies that would allow us to deal successfully with our needs and challenges, or worse yet, the potential for order to break down. We had a glimpse of it on January 6th. I spent several years as the U.S. envoy to the Northern Ireland peace talks, and the idea that politically inspired violence, we saw the damage it did over there over the course of three decades. And I've come away thinking that we shouldn't somehow assume or be sanguine that it couldn't happen, here. I take that possibility more seriously than I'm comfortable with.
And you write that countries around the world are watching the United States, in some cases looking for signs of chaos or dysfunction. And January 6th events were very popular on TV, for example, in China. You worry that if we're not getting things right here, it will encourage authoritarians around the world and discourage people who might embrace democracy otherwise.
Absolutely. The Chinese, the Russians, and others like nothing more than to see divisions here. On one hand, it justifies, at least in their lights, their own repression, their own lack of freedom, their own lack of respect for rights. They're also hoping that our internal divisions make it more difficult for us to come together to do things. I don't think it's a reach to think that Vladimir Putin, one of the reasons he thought he might have a relatively free hand in Ukraine, is he thought the United States might be too divided to mount any sort of a successful defense. And then if you look around the world, our friends and allies, by definition, they're people who have put their security or a lot of it in our hands. And if they see us divided, if they see us acting inconsistently without not being steady, then they will think twice or three times about that security decision. And either they will say, hey, we have to take matters in our own hands, which could be potentially dangerous, would certainly lead to a falling off of our influence. Or they may say we have to cozy up to a big neighbor, even if we don't like them, such as Russia or China. And again, that's not a world we want to see. So it turns out what happens here doesn't simply stay here.
You diagnose a fundamental problem with the United States as you see it, that may be behind all of this potential dysfunction. Rights, on the one hand, you're all for rights, you're not against those, but you worry that we've put too much of our focus, our political conversation, our political action, focusing on our individual rights and liberties at the expense of what? Obligations is there in your title.
Absolutely. As you suggest, I'm not against rights. To the contrary, I'm in favor of them. I think Abraham Lincoln had that profound line when he described our reality as our unfinished work. And even here, 2.5 centuries after the founding of this country, there's still a gap in times between our declared rights and the rights in reality. And it's incumbent upon us to narrow or eliminate those gaps wherever we find them. But even if we succeed at that, that's not in and of itself going to make American democracy work. How do you square the circle between, say, a woman's right to choose and the rights of the unborn? Or an individual's rights to acquire and bear arms pursuant to the Second Amendment as they see it, and someone else's right to public safety, or one individual's right as they see it not to get vaccinated or be forced to wear a mask, and yet someone else's right to public health. How do we square these circles? And to me, a rights-based conversation in politics will either lead to deadlock, as we've often seen, to gridlock, or it could lead to violence. So again, my view is not that we shouldn't concern ourselves with rights, but a concern with rights alone is simply not an adequate basis for a democracy to make sure that it delivers to the people and it does so in a nonviolent way. And that's what led me in the direction of obligations.
We're talking to Richard Haass. His newest book is The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think are the duties, the responsibilities, the obligations of citizenship in America? Is it voting? Is it participating in politics in more ways than voting? Are there ways you think we should do more to promote the common good, even if it doesn't directly benefit us as individuals? What do you want to see taught in schools when it comes to civics and how government works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Richard, you have 10 steps here, 10 ways you're hoping American citizens will meet these obligations. Let's start with number one in your book, simply being informed.
It was Ronald Reagan who said that he didn't just want patriotism, but he was very careful to say, I want an informed patriotism. And that means understanding something of our history, something of our political traditions, something about the value of democracy and what it takes to make it work. And then on a day-to-day basis, it means being up to speed on the policy choices that face us. How do you know who to vote for or what to support and what to oppose unless you're informed? And that also begs the question of what does it mean to be informed and how does one get informed? And I would simply say the reason I made it the first obligation is it's the basis for all else. Yes, I want to have people involved and participate to vote and get involved in politics another way. And I made that the second obligation, but it really needs to rest on a foundation of being informed. Recently, there was an encouraging development in New Jersey where the governor signed into law a requirement that all students in New Jersey public schools take courses in information literacy. And the whole idea is to make them critical consumers of information. We're living in an age in which we're bombarded with information. The problem is we're also bombarded with misinformation. How does one tell the difference between the two? Where does one go for better information? So the idea that now in our schools, at least in one state, that's going to be taught, I see that as an encouraging development. And I would hope that other schools in other states would follow suit.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Yeah, you guys just talked on a topic that was interest me. At 30, 40, 50 years old, this is interesting, but I think it would be indispensable to make sure that kids at 16 and 17 got this. So I'm wondering what program is available to disseminate this to and through all high schools in the United States.
Steve, thanks for the call. And civic education, support the teaching of civics is one of your 10 duties of citizens, obligations of citizenship. Could you talk more about that, Richard?
Sure. Thank you, Steve, for raising it. I think it's critical. Just to be clear, civics are taught in quite a few of our high schools. In most of those where it is taught, it gets though only half a year of instruction. There's nothing common necessarily to what is taught in this school district as to another, even within states, much less from state to state. And then civics at the college level and university level, they're offered on virtually every campus, but they're required by almost none. Very few colleges actually require a grounding in civics as a condition for getting your diploma. I'd like to radically change that. I would like middle schools, high schools, colleges, and universities to have mandatory civics. And I would simply say, you know, we wouldn't let someone graduate school not being able to read or write, not being able to count. Well, why is being a citizen in a democracy any less central to that individual and to our collective welfare than these other skills? So I actually think that there needs to be a movement to make civics mandatory. It then, I understand, I'm not naive here. We then have the challenge of coming up with civics that are good and that are widely acceptable. Mm-hmm. All I can say is I'm going to devote a significant chunk of my life going forward to trying to develop that kind of a curriculum at the state and ultimately national level. I just think in part our ability as Americans to stay united requires that we have some common understanding of this country's past, and its present, its values. And if that's the only way, I think we have a chance of working together across our differences.
Thanks for the call, Steve. We're talking to Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. His newest book is called The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the sort of civic obligations he's hoping to promote? Do you want to throw in one of your own? Something you'd like to see, something you see as maybe even a bare minimum of participating in society and politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at his new book, The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. I'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Alice is with us calling from Madison. Alice, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Alice?
I just think that there's two things that we should be doing when asked, and one is vote, and the other one is serve on juries, because those are the obligations that make our system work. There's other things we can do, but those are obligations.
Alice, thanks a lot for the call. Richard, you have different lines on what might be required and what people should do of their own volition. Alice, is we have to vote and we have to be willing to serve on a jury. What do you think?
Well, we don't have to vote in this country. I'd like to think that Americans will vote. You know, there are countries where you're required to vote or show up at the polling place, Australia being one, and if you don't, you're fined. I don't think that would be well received here, but I would like Americans to want to vote. And I would like there to be a situation where those who want to vote don't find it all that difficult, where employers make it easy for employees to vote, where there are adequate polling stations open for a sufficient amount of time, where voting doesn't involve more hurdles, shall we say, than it needs to. But the bigger problem, it turns out, is voters who simply don't take advantage of their right to vote. You know, it's ironic that we've spent so much of our history promoting the right to vote in other countries, and we have a lot of Americans who, for one reason or another, aren't taking advantage of it here. So, but I think it's central, and as I said before, I want people to get involved in politics. I want them to vote, and I'd love that to be on against a backdrop where they are first informed. Jury obligations are a little bit more than that. It's more of a requirement. I would simply say having done it, it's a really interesting thing to do, and it gets you often with people and who you might not normally come into contact with at work or in your neighborhoods, and you see the legal system in action. I don't think you'll ever watch the news quite the same way again if you've served on a jury and you've seen what it's like. So I know so many people spend a lot of calories trying to get out of jury service. It's never convenient. It's never a good time. But it turns out that doing it can be quite revealing. And again, it's something that we owe the system. And if you know we ever find ourselves in hot water ourselves, we're going to want good people to serve on juries. So again, it's a little bit of doing things that you wish that you'd like to think others would do for you.
Alice, thanks for the call. Laura joins us now, also in Madison. Laura, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually have thought a lot about having a mandatory national service year or 2 years as part of just a national norm, and I've had a lot of internal thought experiments, but how would that even work? Like Israel has mandatory service for their youth, but there's a small portion that choose like public service if they have a strong objection to military service. And I'm not suggesting everyone go into the military. I'm thinking service in Senior Corps, AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, and kind of equalizing the term service to not just mean military service, but serving your country in all the different ways we need, because I'm a nurse, and gosh, we need help caring for our seniors as they get older. We need child care.
Laura, point taken. Richard, and you write about ideas of national service, possibly required national service in your book. What are your thoughts on that?
I think national service is really important. There's a lot of areas in this society, as Laura pointed out, where we need more people involved. I also think it'd be really good for this society. We now have a reality where we have so few common experiences. We're separated by geography, by race, by gender, by religion, by class, by politics. And what I love about national service is it would bring people together who might not normally ever come into contact with one another. It could also be a good way to pick up skills. Could be a good way also to teach some civics as part of the experience. I don't think, though, it should be mandatory. I think that would never get accepted, and that would become almost a distraction. So I think what we need to do is make service more desirable, to incentivize it one way or another, whether through economic means. Firms could give could make hiring people who had service, could give them points, if you will, for that. School colleges might say we're more likely to admit someone if he or she takes a year or two off after high school and get some experience in this way. And I think it would be good for the individuals, and I think it would be good for the society. And I also think, by the way, there's a chance that Congress could actually come together on this. I've spoken to both Republican and Democratic members of Congress. There's a lot of interest in this. And if they were to come together on this, there would then be some resources that would, again, be central if we were going to incentivize people of any age to do this for a year or two. So I actually think this may be an idea whose time has come or will come before long.
Thanks for the call, Laura. We're talking to Richard Haass about his new book, The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. Back to your calls. Jerry is with us in Pewaukee. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I, of course, enjoying the discussion. And, of course, participation and involvement is very important in a general way. But I did want to make the point that I know that many Americans are increasingly upset with the levels of toxicity in our politics. Whether you support the left and the right, there's tremendous disinformation and dishonesty on both sides. There's spin, there's federal investigations of members of Congress and the White House. And so I'd like to hear the gentleman's response regarding there seems to be a valid amount of data for why people would not want to participate in the system.
Interesting point, Jerry. Richard, what do you think?
Look, I understand full well why people are disaffected with the system. They see policies that are not yielding results that have improved their life, whether it's now inflation or there's problems with crime, problems at the border. People disagreed with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a long list. I understand the disaffection. And I also understand why people are put off. Some of the behavior last night at the State of the Union, talk about a lack of civility, a lack of respect for norms. The problem with not getting involved, though, is that you leave politics and the country's future in the hands of others. And why should anyone think that they are going to look out for the collective interest, much less your interest? So my view is, if you're disaffected, if you're frustrated, then double down on your efforts. Get involved. It's the only way I know to change it, if more people vote. Apathy and standing aloof is a recipe, I think, for people who often have more extreme views to have a disproportionate sway over the future of this country.
Jerry, thanks for the call. In our last minute or so, Richard, your final step here is a plea, really, for people at all levels, including politicians, to put country first. Could you leave us with a minute of thoughts on that?
Sure. It's me doing my best effort to channel JFK in his inaugural address, the ask not what your country can do for you, what you can do for your country. The good news is we see examples of it. Whatever you think of their policy positions, Liz Cheney, I think, was an example of it. Some of the state secretaries of state at the state level who stood by the integrity of the political process, even there were pressures not to. So there are Americans willing to do the right thing. And then it's up to us to reward them, not to penalize them for putting the country first. It's up to us to make sure that people who do put the country first are rewarded for doing so.
And just briefly, the book just came out last week. What kind of response are you getting so far?
Well, good news, I'm proud to say, is it made the New York Times bestseller list at number 10. And I think what that says is not so much that the book is great. People will form their own opinions when they read it. But I'm tapping into something. People know there's something a bit off the rails, a bit amiss with American politics, with what's going on in our society and our democracy. And a lot of people out there, even people who may disagree politically, know that we have to do something different to save this experiment called the United States of America.
Richard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. We talked with him about his new book. It's called The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a political rhetoric expert about President Biden's State of the Union address last night and how he handled the messaging to his own party and to his critics. Then we'll hear from another candidate in Wisconsin's race for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. Remember, you can follow election information and news online anytime at WPR.org or on the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.